This is a CBC podcast. Bored of the same old sounds? CBC Radio 2 and Radio 3 have tons of great music to satisfy your musical cravings. Subscribe to Canada Live for the best live concerts from across the country, and the R330 for your weekly countdown of the best new Canadian independent music. You'll find those and more at cbc.ca/podcasting.
So this year's theme is our Robots Man's new best friend. Question mark.
One.
This is your life.
It was a very, very short conversation when you were at a party and somebody asked you what you did and you said you worked with fonts. It was, oh.
Two.
This is your digital life.
A lot of people say, oh, that's kind of creepy or weird. But in fact, this is, you know, a really important part of their relationship.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This time on Spark, it's all about your point of view. As we rush to document more and more aspects of our lives, is the world ready for hidden cameras that capture what you see around you? And sure, robots will one day be our overlords, but what about the lighter side? A robot film festival aims to flesh out the pop culture image of bots. Plus, if you've ever been in a long-distance relationship, you know how hard it can be to have a full sense of your sweetheart's life. How digital technology is bridging the gap. First up, is that a letter K or a P? I'm really looking forward to the annual Spelunkers Conference in Sicily. Okay, I want an all-access pass for the 3 full days. Now my credit card info. All right. Oh, wait. Ugh, I forgot about the CAPTCHA. Is that a K or is that a P? Oh, didn't work. And now I have a new set of distorted letters, and they're even worse. Not again. I'm really a person, not a spam bot. Let me in. Maybe I'll try again next year. CAPTCHA stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. You've probably run into CAPTCHAs when you're buying concert tickets or submitting a comment at a blog. There's a good reason for them. They prevent spam bots from doing things like buying up all the concert tickets. But a lot of people hate them because they can be so hard to decipher. And if lately it seems like those squiggly, distorted letters are getting harder to solve, there's a good reason for that.
So when CAPTCHA started about 10 years ago, they were a way to use a simple test. Person could type in a few characters to tell that they're real. Now, the reason that was difficult for computers is they use a technology called optical character recognition, mm-hmm. OCR, to actually read in those characters. Now, since the advent of CAPTCHA, computers have gotten really, really good at doing that. And as they get better, the CAPTCHAs have to get worse and worse.
Right.
So now when you see those CAPTCHAs, I think most of them are easier for bots to decipher than they are for actual people to decipher.
This is Reed Totoris. He's one of the co-founders of Are You a Human?, a company that's designed an alternative way to prove you're not a bot.
So we've got a different solution, what we call playthrough. So we ask you to complete a short 10 to 12 second game. For example, we'll show you a fridge and some floating shapes, and we'll say, drag the food into the fridge. So for people, you can obviously see that milk is food and a tire, for example, is not food.
Right.
So when we see that on average, the completion times are around 12 seconds, which is the same as it tends to take a person for a CAPTCHA. But as people get really good at doing it, that time goes down even further. And what we try and do is we try and get kind of a natural tension in these games. So that when you look at an image, you see something you want to fix. So put the food in the fridge. Or we have one game where you build a face, like a Mr. Potato Head.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at this and you can kind of instinctively see, oh, these eyes and this mouth go on the face. But that's not as easy for computers to recognize.
Right. Okay, so that's what makes this a good way of determining whether someone is a person or a bot, is that it's not just that they have to see it, it's that they have to understand a sort of context, I guess, right? That milk is the kind of thing that would go in a fridge.
Yeah, no, that's a little more around making it easier for people.
I see.
But what makes it the most difficult is that we have an algorithm that looks at your interaction with the game. So a traditional CAPTCHA will just say, did you get the correct code or not? With our game, you have to follow the instructions, but we also look at how you complete the game. So do you reach for objects in a human-like manner? Where do you click on an object? How long does it take you? We collect all this data and process this through our algorithm, and we can see if you actually behave like a person. So in order to break the game, you don't have to just write a program to perform the task we ask you to perform, but you have to mimic human behavior, and that becomes more difficult.
And so why did you want to make this a game?
So as we approached this, we first started from a security standpoint to try and say, how can CAPTCHAs work better? But as we talked to people, we found the much bigger problem is this usability issue, that people just hate using the CAPTCHA. It's difficult. It's stressful. It's this annoying experience. And a game is something that's simple, that's intuitive. We see that, you know, in evolution of games are going to even quicker and quicker games. Now people are kind of used to playing a lot of these short things. So for us, what we're trying to do is take this universally bad experience and turn it into a positive experience. And I think adding a fun game aspect to it helps us do that.
Hmm. The games do have a North American flavor to them. You know, the instructions are in English, and while a lot of the tasks are universal, some of them, like making pancakes or building a pizza, might not be familiar to people who are living in other parts of the world. Have you gotten any feedback about that?
Yeah, we have. So we launched our beta early December,
mm-hmm.
and we've gotten a lot of great feedback. We've had questions from people in France, in Portugal, in Brazil, in Russia, and have asked us, do we have other language options? So on the language side, we want to translate those, and that's something that's in our plan we're going to eventually be able to do. But we've also seen, like you mentioned, some of these tasks that we think as universal aren't as universal as we think. I even had some people complain that they don't like olives, so why are you making me put olives on a pizza? And pancakes, of course, for people that come from North America, it's generally, you understand, you put syrup and butter on pancakes. So as we have done these games, we've gotten better at recognizing what is more universal, and try and get even better as we continue to do that. So I think the face game was an example, putting things in a fridge, a toolbox. We've got a game with a garden, and, you know, we've kind of incorporated into our process is, you know, how would someone who's born in France or how would someone who's born in India look at this game, and would it make sense to them?
I suppose an advantage of one particular type of CAPTCHA, which is the reCAPTCHA, is that while you're typing out the text and recognizing it, you're recognizing the blurry text of books that Google Books has scanned. So it kind of accomplishes a productive task along with doing this annoying thing of trying to recognize blurry text. And I wondered if down the road you could design games that actually accomplish a productive task.
Yeah, I think first step for us is looking at this experience that while it is, I think, reCAPTCHA is better than doing a CAPTCHA that doesn't translate books at all. There is some value there. It's still not a great experience for the person, and you're still being forced to do it. So step one for us is to try and improve that experience and give people a fun time. And then down the road, as we improve our algorithm and come up with new games, I think we can definitely use this to collect data. So we can ask people preference questions. If you're a website that maybe you have a cooking blog that's using our game, you could ask us to work with us to develop a food game and say, what's your favorite food? We can have people choose what that food is and pass that data back to the website. So now you understand something about your users. And as you get to a larger and larger website with more frequent visits, that can become more and more valuable.
Hmm. So what's been the interest from websites so far?
We've gotten good traction. We're now live on about 250 websites. And we did about 300,000 games last month and have done over 2 million games so far. So it's been a really good response. We've talked to a lot of our customers so far are people who own their own blog or run their own website, and these are people who are really passionate about whatever their site does, and they really it really irks them that they have to present this CAPTCHA. So we found those people have been a little quicker to adopt.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Reed. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Reed Totoris is a co-founder of Are You a Human, the company behind Playthrough. We found another company, Sweet Captcha, that also plays around with the idea of a game-based human verification system. If you'd like to check these out and see how they compare to the traditional Captcha experience, we'll post the links on our website, cbc.ca/spark. What are you doing here?
Nothing.
You're looking at me weird.
No, I'm not.
You got new glasses.
How do you like them?
They're cool. They're kind of like oversized aviator glasses. Very futuristic.
Mm-hmm. Very fashion forward. And see this little dot here?
Yeah.
Tiny
the bridge?
Little, yeah, right in the center.
Yeah.
That is a camera.
What?
It's a 1080 high def camera with audio recording capability.
Wow.
I know.
Hey, wait a minute. Are you filming me right now?
Gotcha!
Oh, get out of here.
Candyman, still mad?
Are you still filming me?
No, but I've got the glasses. Do you want to check them out?
Ah, sure. I'm a sucker for anything that invades my privacy.
Okay, these glasses by Pivot Head are coming out this month.
Okay.
And what's so big about this particular deal is that they are in the vanguard of something called point of view technology.
Okay, explain that to me.
So when I got this pair, I put them on and wandered around my neighborhood talking to people I knew and then came home and dumped the files into my laptop. And then, lo and behold, up popped this astonishingly clear, high-def movie that had recorded everything I saw from my own point of view.
Huh.
This meaning, now I can broadcast my point of view video out to the entire world.
Okay, but why on earth would you want to share your point of view with the world?
That's exactly what I asked Zach Barbita at Pivothead.
If you look at human nature, you know, humans are wired to talk about themselves and to, you know, explore and to try something new and different. And now they can actually record it. So, you know, point of view is really something that we've really just seen the tip of. You know, we see people every day spending hours, hours monthly on social media websites, and it's because they're wanting to tell people about themselves and about their vantage points and about what they did today.
Yeah, I can see that. It's kind of a piece with blogging and tweeting. And actually, it's really an extension of what we already do all the time, which is snap a gajillion photographs with our cell phone cameras.
Yeah, that's right. And now we can snap our very own high-def movies. But so far, the glasses can only hold about an hour's worth of video, and then that means that you have to download what you've got and then begin filming again.
Okay. And can you pull the video off the glasses wirelessly?
Yeah, you can do it with an Android smartphone. You connect the glasses to the phone with a wire and transmit your movies to your website or to your social media profile. And Nora, make no mistake, I think these personal movies are going to be an extremely hot commodity. And whoever owns the site for where they're posted and visited is going to have a captive audience. I remember I couldn't quite make out why Google paid $1.65 billion for YouTube. Now I get it.
That people want to watch videos that other people have shot and share them. And actually, this is part of a bigger trend that we've talked about on the show before, which is the videoization, as it were, of the internet. It's just becoming much more visual and much more videoed. And you can imagine where this could actually go if you had tons and tons of people walking around with these cameras embedded in their glasses.
Exactly.
But how is privacy going to work? In the old days, you know, you could tell if you were being filmed because you could see the camera. Isn't this potentially a big problem if the camera is essentially concealed?
I did ask Zach about that, and he feels that for the most part, the glasses will be used for good by people wanting to share extreme sports experience, you know, parents sharing kids' games. But of course, there's always going to be things like peeping Toms. Right. My imagination goes to things like people, you know, maybe recording your PIN number when you're at your bank, or people filming concerts illegally, that kind of thing. But, you know, being under constant surveillance, unfortunately, is nature of life in the 21st century.
it's, and, you know, it's yet to be defined if that's a good or bad thing. You know, I'm based out of Manhattan, and, you know, they say any corner you walk down of, you know, any street block that you walk down of, you're probably on, you know, 16 or different cameras between, you know, Homeland Security, you know, bank machines, private video surveillance. So, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, you have to assume at all times you're on video, because the reality of the situation is, you know, everyone has the capability to do it. And, you know, even more so is whether you like it or not, when you're out in the public, there's always cameras going. There's always people recording.
Okay, fair point. But the thing about security cameras is they're not, by and large, uploading security camera footage to YouTube.
Yes, Nora, and you better watch out for me at the Christmas party with a lampshade, if you happen to go out there with a lampshade on your head, because in seconds it could be all over the world. But in all seriousness, I think that a person could be filming a violent crime with these glasses, and they could send that to the police station and perhaps save a life. I think reporters could slip into certain zones unseen without this and be able to wirelessly upload it. So I think the possibilities are amazing.
Okay, but how do you think sort of just regular people might use something like this?
This is crystal balling it a bit, but when you think about how we're all blogging our lives, we're tweeting, we're sharing photos, and this point of view technology offers us the chance to really kick it up another notch. Like a single person, if you follow my logic, a single mm-hmm. person could act as an entertainment hub. My Facebook site or my blog could be the equivalent of Kathy Bond TV.
Yikes.
But, you know, it could be done. We as individuals have the technology now to create our very own entertainment channels.
So is this narcissism unleashed or finally an escape from reality TV?
Well, I hope it is an escape from reality TV. But, you know, if Zach is right and what's driving the point of view movement is our deep human need to tell our own stories, then you have to admit this really does make kind of a logical sense.
I think that this is probably the future. I would not be surprised at all to see these kinds of things in common use. Thanks for bringing them in.
Oh, you're welcome.
Are you filming me again?
I am.
Now, admit it, you want to see both what these glasses look like and what kind of images they take. Well, we shot a video. It's up on the Spark website, cbc.ca/spark. And the glasses retail for somewhere around $350. Going on in New York City this summer, they're reviving the play Harvey on Broadway. Alicia Keys is playing Central Park. And then there's the second annual Robot Film Festival. Yep, for 2 days in July, there will be a celebration of robots on film. And not just the silver screen robots you've grown to love or hate, but new robot films made by anyone, even you. Heather Knight is co-founder of the Fest. A few weeks back, she was on Spark telling me all about the robot stand-up comedian she created. Heather's goal with the Robot Film Fest is to examine the positive side of robots on film, as a counter to the way robots are so often depicted in TV and movies in North America.
Well, there is a certain stereotype of a Terminator-type scenario where artificial intelligence will naturally want to sort of take over the world, or it will go wrong.
Sarah Connor?
Yes.
Perhaps because of certain Western religions, this idea of that we would be usurping God's role were we to create life ourselves, and this idea that artificial intelligence is a kind of life, so it will naturally go wrong.
Right, because we have a lot of lessons like Frankenstein and so forth when these things don't actually go right.
Exactly.
Was that the way you thought about robots yourself when you were growing up? After all, you are a roboticist.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely not the only story that's out there. We have, like, a lot of positive storytelling about robots, like WALL-E. Like Johnny Five.
Call me Johnny Five.
I wasn't always in love with robots. Like, I kind of fell for them when I started building them at college. And I originally wanted to be a writer. So what's been sort of interesting about my career path studying, like, electrical engineering and going to MIT and now at Carnegie Mellon is that 10 years later, after starting playing with robots, I'm now using robots to tell stories by creating artificial characters on stage or on screen.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, though, because it's not true in all cultures that there's a sort of negative narrative about robots. You know, in Japanese pop culture, for instance, has lots and lots of positive images of robots. Why do you think we tend to see them in mostly negative terms here, at least, you know, at the movies?
Yeah, it's interesting. Japanese people tend to grow up with, like, Astro Boy. It's their most popular television series and a comic book in the last couple decades. Mm-hmm. And basically, he is their Superman. And because he's a machine, he doesn't have human flaws. And he almost shows us how to more completely accomplish what we're capable of. I mean, even going back to that Frankenstein myth, I think if you actually kind of look at the creation story of Frankenstein with Dr. Frankenstein creating his monster, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't really like that. Like, he was very dedicated. He was like a scientist. Like, he got really interested in what he was doing. But as soon as he actually accomplished it, he rejected it and threw it into the woods.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I think like any kid that is immediately rejected by its parent and every person that sees it and thrown into the woods to raise itself is going to have some psychological issues.
So what's the inspiration behind the Robot Film Festival?
One of the motivations was to get other people playing with robots on stage because I'm interested in robots that have character. But I was also really excited about showcasing more positive storytelling about robots. I think that in the same way mythology can inspire our expectations of technology, it can also change the kind of things that we want to create. If Japan is a society that thinks that technology will naturally want to live in harmony with people, and they're focusing on things like machines that can help elderly stay independent for longer, and really putting a lot of emphasis into technology development for social robots in our everyday lives. Whereas the U.S. Overall, as you know, puts a lot of investment into military robots. It's interesting to think about: is there a loop there where that storytelling is happening? And it's not that there's not a lot of other really fantastic and interesting research happening in robotics in the U.S. or even that stuff isn't important. But whether it's movies, whether it's films, whether it's stories, whether it's science fiction, it helps us stretch our imagination and even think about what we care about and what we want, and ideally shape the direction that goes.
I understand you're looking for submissions from the public on a particular theme. What's that?
Yeah, so this year's theme is Are Robots Man's New Best Friend? ? So it's kind of like this analysis about our relationship with technology and society today. Like, in what ways will new technologies or are new technologies shaping the way we relate to each other? If I am in a long-distance relationship and mostly talk to my boyfriend over email or over Skype, that's a really different type of engagement than, or even a different type of thing that would be possible than something a long time ago. If their parents are using their Blackberries at the dinner table instead of hanging out with their kids. If, you know, freshmen are arriving at college for the first time with like 200 Facebook friends, but not able to strike up a conversation at a cocktail party. Like we are transformed by what we use and by our tools in positive and negative ways. And I'm curious about how that will play out with robots. And I am excited about inviting all of you to help explore that question by making short films.
So you don't have to be a professional filmmaker to participate in the film festival?
No, but professional filmmakers are okay. You guys can apply too. But no, we have a pretty diverse set of contributors. Last year we had research robots that were taking their first like on-screen role and like dramatizing things. We had more documentations type stuff that was just really fascinating, interesting. We had people running around in cardboard costumes or making music videos with flip cams. The important part is just having a robot as a main character or as an overarching element of the narrative. To just have fun, like have big ideas and then we can share it all together. It's like a full day event. We have a red carpet Botskers award ceremony, so a robot Oscars. We're really into creating a community, and stuff gets shared on our Vimeo channel so that you can see the films from last year, and it's awesome.
We'll post a link to that at our website. Thanks so much for telling us about it, Heather.
Thank you.
Heather Knight is a social roboticist at Carnegie Mellon University.
Wally.
And when she's not doing that, she's also the executive director of the Robot Film Festival. June 7th is the deadline to submit your own robot film. We'll have a link to the festival over at our blog, cbc.ca/spark, and a link to the videos from last year's fest.
Nice.
Still ahead on Spark, this past week, the issue of copyright was back in the news as Bill C-11, the proposed copyright legislation, came out of committee. As it gets closer to passing into law, we'll update you on what the legislation means to you. And if you've ever been in a long-distance relationship, you know that it can be both a yearning, idealized romance and a minefield of jealousy and misinformation. Can new technologies of connection build more realistic, healthy love affairs? Plus, type design is an art with a long pedigree. How does that change when you're designing not for the printed page or for giant billboards, but for the wee screens of our digital devices? That's coming up when Spark continues. In design news, have you ever sat in someone else's chair and thought, too hard, too soft, or just right? Sure, because our bodies are all different. Either that or you're Goldilocks. Well, now German designers Kram Weishaar are working on designing the ultimate chair based on stress tests. What they did is set up their R18 Ultra chair at the Milan Furniture Show, tricked out with sensors, and then they invited thousands of visitors to the show to sit in the chair so they could assess where the stress points were from thousands of different bottoms sitting on the chair. The idea is to produce the lightest chair possible without it breaking under the weight and stress of any of those body types. I guess you could say the public really got behind the research. Young, this is Spark from your friends at CBC Radio. It's time to update you on one of Canada's ongoing sagas. A tale that divides loyalties, that spans the decades. Yep, that's correct. Copyright revision. The last time the Canadian Copyright Act was revised was way back in 1997, and there have been successive attempts at updating it to reflect the fact that, gee, some things have changed in media since 1997. This past fall, Bill C-11 marked the latest attempt to do so. Now the bill's come out of committee and awaits third reading. There were some last-minute amendments proposed, and we thought it was a good time to check back on the story and what the bill may mean to you. David Feuer is the director of the Samuel Glushko Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic at the University of Ottawa. CIPIC has intervened on behalf of creators groups and consumers groups, and not so much on behalf of distribution groups. I started by asking David about those last-minute amendments.
The committee reviewing the bill suggested a bunch of amendments, and that's the purpose of the committee stage back in the House, where the House considers the recommendations of the committee and either adopts or rejects them. The committee itself had rejected the Liberal and NDP proposals, how to amend C-11, and of course accepted the government recommendations. Again, in the House this week, what the House did was adopt the committee proposals and considered a bunch of new amendments proposed by the Green Party and the NDP and roundly disposed of those proposals and just accepted the proposals from the committee.
Okay, so when you and I last talked, we were actually looking at Copyright Bill C-32, which died last spring when Parliament dissolved. And then in the fall, this new bill, Bill C-11, was introduced, and it was exactly the same, except that now the context, of course, is that we have a majority government.
Exactly.
So has anything sort of substantive changed since C-11 was originally introduced in the fall?
There were a few tweaks. So, a few technical amendments, dealing with treaties and things like that, and some clarifications more than anything else.
Well, how would you characterize C-11 in terms of its ability to balance, these competing interests, the interests of copyright holders, consumers, and artists, and fair dealing?
Well, I've always referred to this legislation as a Jekyll and Hyde bill, because half of it is very, very good, and half of it is very, very bad. when it's dealing with just copyright, you know, things like user rights and author's rights and, you know, rationalizing the penalties that are built into the statute, making them more sensical, I think the bill does a pretty good job. But then when it turns to the digital lock side, you know, new protections that are afforded to digital locks, you know, technologies that are designed to keep you out of content, there, any sense of balance and proportion is thrown out in favor of a very hard line.
The issue was that if digital locks are in place, even if you otherwise would have the ability to make use of something, to copy something, you can't. So the digital lock kind of trumps what we would ordinarily be allowed to do according to fair dealing, right?
Yeah, that's a good example. And even looking internally within the bill itself, the bill creates some long-needed exceptions for things like what we call time shifting, using, you know, your parents' VCR or your PVR, you know, to record a show to watch later. That's never been legal, technically, under Canadian copyright law, and we're finally fixing that in this bill. But then, as soon as you throw a digital lock into the equation, all those user rights disappear. So if some distributor decides to put some encryption on your DVD, for example, then you can't break the DVD to access the content and put it onto your iPod. And that's the big example that we give. You know, you buy a CD, you can rip the music and put it on your iPod. You buy a Hollywood movie, you can't rip the movie and put it on that same device. And the only reason is because of the digital lock that's on the DVD. You can't break the CSS encryption on the DVD and put it on your device.
So given that, I mean, it seems to me that that whole issue of digital locks trumping these other rights is what's been most controversial. So is that where a lot of the debate and discussion in committee centered on?
Oh, absolutely. There were a slew of proposals from committee trying to fix up the problems with the digital lock side. I mean, there's two ways to do it. One is to fix the digital lock stuff so it's no longer making illegal what is otherwise legal. Or if you're not going to do that, then you start to create, you know, or propose lots of little exceptions to capture all the little activities that people want to do, things like ripping, you know, a movie that you own to put it on your device of choice. And both of those approaches were rejected by the government members of the committee, and then again in the House this week.
You know, David, despite several attempts at revising it, the Copyright Act hasn't been updated since, I believe, 1997. So is there an argument for saying, look, we're just never going to please all sides in this, let's just get this done?
I think that is the government's proposal here, and I think that's usually a good sign in copyright. When everybody's equally irritated at the legislation, you probably struck a balanced bill. That doesn't mean that everything in the bill is right, just that there's enough in the bill to at least partially please all the stakeholders in front of you. And I think this government doesn't see much value in continuing to debate copyright law. They've got a bill, enough people are happy with enough parts of it to push it through, and I think that's the strategy.
David, thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
David Feuer is director of the Samuel Glushko Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic at the University of Ottawa. There's a longer version of my conversation with David at the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark.
Time, weather, and...
You know, people who work in radio talk about driveway moments. Those times when you're listening to something so great that you just sit in your car in the driveway because you don't want to turn off the radio. And our goal as radio producers is to try to create those driveway moments. That's great and all, but why should you be a slave to your radio? You can take the radio with you by subscribing to your favorite podcasts. And I really hope Spark can be one of those faves. The Spark podcast is completely free. You don't need to have an iPod to listen to it. Just click subscribe and Spark will be delivered free to your computer's music library every week. You even get it earlier than the broadcast. It comes to you every Friday. Just visit cbc.ca/spark, click on podcast at the top of the page, and we'll get you kitted out. Never be a slave to your radio or your driveway again. Here on Spark, we spend a lot of time in virtual relationships. We swap tweets and Facebook messages with members of the broader Spark community. Within the unit itself, we often communicate via a little group chat client. Meeting face-to-face is so human, after all. And because I talk to guests all over the world, I'm not usually face-to-face with the people I'm interviewing.
Hello?
Hi, is that Carmen?
This is Carmen. How are you, Nora?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, good.
And sometimes the technology just isn't working quite right. We're just sort of resolving a couple little technical issues on our end. We think some monkeys were in the studio before we got in here. And it can get in the way of creating the kind of relaxed, transparent communication environment you want to have. And instead, you're focused on the technology. It seems hissy. Exactly. That's what I thought. The line seems hissy.
Hmm, that's weird. Hmm.
But eventually, we generally figure it out and carry on. Is it okay? Are we good? Okay, good. All right. This used to be something broadcasters dealt with, but now, for many of us, it's an everyday reality. Our communication is mediated by digital technology. And even though we're sometimes aware of that technology, usually when it doesn't work...
No. I can't hear you. You're breaking up. But hello?
We become pretty adept at getting beyond the gear to what we humans love, connecting. Carmen Neustadter is a prof in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University. Along with his University of Calgary colleague Saul Greenberg, he's been researching how couples in long-distance relationships use tech to stay in touch. Now, people in long-distance relationships have long had tools for staying in touch, of course, you know, the Sunday night phone call or email or even good old-fashioned paper letters. What are you finding is different now in terms of the tools that people can use to keep in touch?
What we're seeing now is really what I would call a game changer in communication technology, and that's video chat, which is coming the closest to lifelike situations that we've ever had. And so just by being able to see your partner over distance, it allows couples to really sort of change the nature of their activities that they're able to do when they're apart.
Can you expand on that a little bit? How does it allow them to change the nature of their connection?
They're actually using video chat in a way that creates this idea of shared living. So they're trying to connect their two remote residences in a way that makes it seem like they're actually still living together. So they basically come home in the evening, both partners, and turn on their video connection and will leave it going for several hours in the evening until they both go to bed and essentially do the things they would do if they were normally living together.
A while ago on Spark, Carmen, we did an item on Skype sleeping, which is this phenomenon where couples who are in long-distance relationships will fall asleep and wake up while they're connected by web chat. And so I'd like to play you a little bit of Kai Hasselreis's documentary on one couple's Skype sleeping.
Just before we go to bed, we go on this website that plays, like, nature sounds.
A mixture of, like, beach, crickets, and, like...
fire crackling and some thunder.
Every night, this is the bedtime ritual for couple Matthew Giesbrecht and Justin Roberge.
Yeah, Matthew usually plays it on his side of the computer, and then I just turn my speaker down a little bit, and then that's what we fall asleep to.
But Matthew and Justin aren't falling asleep together in the same room. They're over 2,000 kilometers apart.
Can you reflect on that a little bit? I mean, it seems to me that when you're in a relationship with a person, it's not necessarily that you want to connect to convey information to each other. It's sometimes you just want to have that sense of presence, right?
That's exactly it, Nora. And we saw a similar thing happening with the couples in our study, where essentially they would continue to do the things they normally do, which is falling asleep with one another. Sometimes people's time zones don't line up when they're connecting over distance. And so maybe one person kind of falls asleep earlier than the other and essentially does sort of do that thing where they watch the other person fall asleep. A lot of people say, oh, that's kind of creepy or weird. But in fact, this is, you know, a really important part of their relationship. It makes them feel close. It makes them feel present. It makes them feel intimate with one another.
And it's an interesting thing about how the changing technology facilitates that, right? I mean, there, in the past, obviously with the telephone, there would have been a huge cost involved in staying on the telephone with somebody half a world away for several hours at a time, or even with paper letters, there's a kind of, you know, you can't keep constantly writing. You've got to write the letter and then send it and wait for it back. So how new do you think this is in changing the character of long-distance relationships?
You know, this stuff isn't something we could have done a few years ago, but because video chat is now readily available, you know, we can get it free, basically. Webcams are pretty cheap and inexpensive. And it's really about the seeing the other person. That sort of seeing makes you kind of feel closer. It makes you believe that they're actually there and present with you. It's actually quite amazing how rapidly the uptake of video chat has come about in the home, especially when you compare it to sort of the workplace, where it's actually sort of been used for the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, but not as rapidly as we've seen it come up in the home.
But, you know, one of the things that interested me about one of the write-ups that you did about your study was that sometimes people are really, they're basically not really interacting with each other. It's almost like having this sort of passive awareness that they might not even be talking to each other.
Yeah, that's true. We saw a lot of that where couples essentially would kind of be doing their own thing in their house and the video chat would just be going. But you can kind of think of that as akin to the way, you know, a couple might live together, where, you know, maybe one person's watching TV, maybe one person's starting supper, and they're both kind of, you know, doing their own thing. But essentially, they still feel the presence of the other person. And it's that presence that is really powerful.
Mm-hmm. And what role do you think video chat in particular plays in maintaining the health of the relationship?
If you look at the literature that talks about long-distance relationships, couples often who are in a long-distance relationship idealize about their partner, where they sort of think about their relationship in an ideal way. You know, everybody's really in love and things are you know, great and fantastic. But they don't sort of talk about things that might be conflicting, and they avoid sort of the things that may hurt the relationship. But what we saw with video chat that was really cool was sort of couples move beyond this idealization and would actually kind of be more like a couple that was actually living together. And so they'd be much more realistic about their relationship, which I think is really important because it makes that relationship stronger. It makes the couple have, a better chance of sort of lasting in their relationship.
What about using video chat for sexual intimacy?
Yeah, so we did talk with couples about that as well and found that only a small number of people in our study actually would engage in sort of full-on cyber sex with their partner over video chat. At least, you know, those are the people that told us about it. And for them, it was really important because they did want to engage with their partner in a more kind of physical way. But maybe more interestingly than that is that technology often got in the way. You couldn't do certainly the things you wanted to do because you're essentially watching the other person. And so for a lot of other people, they said, you know, it was kind of awkward or, you know, they didn't feel right doing it. So I think we still have a long ways to go to get sort of physical interaction over distance to the point that people actually need it.
You and your fellow researcher Saul Greenberg study human-computer interaction and how technologies can act as a bridge to connect human beings. So I'm wondering what this research suggests in terms of how we might design our technologies better in the future.
Even though couples are kind of sharing life over video chat, the systems are really designed in a way that's much more meant for kind of talking heads. So you see the other person, you can talk to them back and forth. But really what we need are our video communication tools that allow us to share everyday life, to share our experiences, so they can capture a broader range of areas. They can allow people to engage in sort of more physical, intimate activities and essentially connect people over long durations of time. So the video chat tools are good, but they're still not designed quite the way we actually need them to be.
Mm-hmm. So beyond just strictly couples in a relationship, do you see a point at which these kind of telepresence tools mean that we actually can work remotely and we can actually sort of successfully connect and not feel out of the loop or missing? Or is there still something about needing to be physically present with other people?
I think that we're seeing the technology get really good. It's hard to say, if we'll still need that sort of connection by having somebody in person. I personally think it's going to get to a point where we can sort of recreate the person, regardless of where they are, and make it feel like they're present with you. But we still have a ways to go, and there's lots of research going on in the community of human-computer interaction that tries to do just this, to make things even more realistic. We'll get there, but I think it's going to still, you know, take a number of years.
Carmen, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Carmen Neustadter is a prof in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. If you're interested in learning more, we've got a link to Carmen and Saul Greenberg's paper on their research. How about you? Are you in a long-distance relationship? How do you use technology to stay connected to your sweetie? Leave a comment at the blog cbc.ca/spark or stay connected with me via email spark@cbc.ca. In an episode of Spark from earlier in the year, we asked you to walk down memory lane and share your early memories of using a word processor.
A roommate of mine had a TRS-80, or as we called him, a Trash-80, and he had a word processor that he had just gotten for it in 1985 that was pretty cool. it would actually type different fonts. I didn't know what a font was. I thought a font was something that a baby was baptized in.
The days when we used to scratch our heads about fonts is a time my next guest remembers well.
It was a very, very short conversation when you were at a party and somebody asked you what you did, and you said you worked with fonts. It was, oh, and okay, and then that was kind of a really dead end right there. But now people are pretty much pick up on it, and you know, they're familiar with font menus on their computer, they're familiar with changing the settings on their ebook. So fonts are much more part of the day-to-day language now.
That's Steve Madison,
the creative type director for Monotype Imaging.
He's the man behind a lot of the fonts you see and use daily in your digital life.
My typefaces are used in Windows. There's a typeface family called Seago, which is their brand typeface, and also used in their user interface. And I designed the typefaces for both the original Xbox and the Xbox 360. And if you use a Android mobile device, you'd be viewing my Droid Sans and Droid Serif typeface families.
I wanted to talk with Steve about the challenges of designing fonts for our portable technology, especially making them legible on tiny screens. So tell me, what are the features of a font that's legible, that's easy to read?
Principally, the thing that makes typefaces legible is the size of the lowercase letters, because obviously mostly what we read is in lowercase. Mm-hmm. And the lowercase compared to the capitals, a larger X height, as we call it, the lowercase height compared to the capitals, will make a typeface more legible, particularly for a screen or a low-resolution environment. Other aspects include shapes that are more open, have more white space inside of them, and don't close in on themselves. An example would be the lowercase A in Helvetica is very closed up on itself. And if you look at a typeface like Verdana, which is another popular, very legible typeface people use for email, mm-hmm. is very open and has a lot of white space inside of it. So that actually helps quite a bit with readability.
And I suppose it makes a difference what it is that you're asking people to read, right? Are you asking people to read a billboard, or are you asking them to read the fine print on the bottom of a vitamin bottle or something?
Yeah, most definitely. And I guess the vitamin bottle is a great example of terrible typography where people use very condensed typefaces to scrunch all the information
right.
in. Yeah. And so that's another kind of thing. The proportion, the width of the letters is another thing that increases legibility for screens. And also the inter-character spacing is very critical on screens. Usually when people set headlines very big for billboards, they like to tuck the letters nice and tight and mm-hmm. make a impact kind of statement. And you can't really do that if you're trying to do immersive reading on, say, a handheld device where letter forms need to breathe.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk about that a bit more? What do you have to keep in mind when you're designing fonts for specifically for our mobile devices and for these small screens?
Really, it depends on whether you're going to be reading a menu item or like a pull-down menu, or if you're trying to read an article on the mobile web browser. So specifically, you want to make sure there's enough contrast with the background color. So if the user interface is being designed in a, you're going to have white text on a colored background, you need to make sure the typeface is thick enough so that it doesn't sort of bleed into the color. So there's very small nuance that you have to take into consideration on the entire design. And then individual letter forms, like I was saying, need to be treated so that they have openness and can breathe. But reading on devices these days is becoming quite a bit easier than even on your desktop web browser, because the screens have such a high pixel density. They're very, very fine pixels. And you can show a lot more nuance and typographic detail. So you can actually read a novel in a typeface that would be designed for a printed novel on these handheld devices, because there's more pixels to represent those letter forms.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking back to, you know, what websites looked like in the late 90s, where the fonts would often be in Courier, and they had this kind of clunky type of look, presumably because of the limitations of the time, whereas now we have much higher resolutions on screens than before. So is it still like designing for two different environments, designing for an electronic environment versus a paper environment, or has the standard for electronics become so high that there's not that much of a difference?
We're right now in kind of a time where we're really bleeding together from print and screen. You can almost design for both the same, with some consideration for screen, whereas before you were very, very limited. But there's a technology called web fonts now where you can actually choose any typeface you would like, put it into your website, and it gets loaded onto anybody's website as part of an asset, just like a photo or a graphic would. So you can actually convey, you know, your whole page, typeface included now, via the web, and you weren't able to do that even just a few years ago. Hmm. So it's becoming more and more like print every day, really.
What are some of your favorite fonts for mobile devices?
For mobile specifically, I'd have to say some of the ones I've done. I mean, it sounds selfish, but I think we really worked hard to get a really good readable experience. In the past, said things about Helvetica, which, you know, Helvetica's on the iPhone, and I have an iPhone. But Helvetica was designed for signage. It's very tight, it's very closed up, and very difficult to read. And every time I hear my father-in-law say he can't read his iPhone, I know it's because the typeface is just not designed for legibility. So things that I've worked on, the Android fonts, and even in the 80s, a typeface called Lucida was designed by my mentor, Chuck Bigelow. It's used in the menus on Mac OS, and it's a very clear, readable design. So some of those are, I think, would be my favorites, I would say.
And can I ask you one totally selfish question that's been preying on my mind here at Spark?
Absolutely.
Is it easier to read something on a screen if it has serifs or not?
It depends on the resolution of your screen. That's not a very self-indulgent question. It's a very popular question.
Okay.
And there's a lot of research over the years about whether a serif typeface is more legible than a sans serif. And they're almost entirely inconclusive because there might be something in the experiment which causes basically the control to go away. For instance, they might set a sans serif typeface too tightly. In other words, the lines are too close together.
The serif lines are like the lines at the bottom of the letter, right?
Right. The serifs are those little ending strokes on the letter forms. So in a sans serif typeface, when it's set, it needs to have more letting, more space in between the lines. Think of double-spaced text when you're setting a term paper, for instance. It makes it easier to read because your eye, once it gets to the end of the line, it doesn't, you know, double back and skip, or it finds the next line much more easily. And some of the research that was done, they didn't take that into consideration. So, you know, that would obviously make a sans serif more difficult to read than a serif design, where these little feet along the baseline help guide your eye left to right. Mm. So, yeah, on a screen, however, you have the issue of resolution and whether serifs end up looking really blocky and distracting, mm-hmm. or whether they even touch each other. If the resolution is really low, you'll start having serifs touching and cause letters to bleed together. And that's not a good thing for legibility. And that's why I think in the 90s, particularly when you're looking at your desktop cathode ray screens, mm-hmm. You would have these big blocky pixels, and so it makes serif typefaces less easy to read. But now, like I was saying earlier, with the higher pixel density of mobile device screens, serif typefaces are looking quite good and easy to read.
Debate solved. Thanks so much for talking to us, Steve.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Steve Madison is Creative Type Director at Monotype Imaging. We'll post a link to some of the fonts he's created on our website. That's cbc.ca/spark. And that's also where you can hear a longer version of my conversation with Steve. I asked him about the process of creating fonts that convey a particular mood or tone. Once again, cbc.ca/spark. And that's all she wrote for Spark this time around. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Jean Kim, Anshuman Idemsetti, and me, Nora Young. Special thanks this week to intern Laura Anderson, who's back at J School now to finish off the year. And by
Reed Tatoris,
Kathy Bond,
Heather Knight,
David Feuer,
Carmen Neustater,
and
Steve Madison.
And from the Spark community,
this is Eric Van Wiesenbeck calling from Barrie.
Head over to our blog. You can find more information, longer form interviews with our guests, and explore our expanding library of videos. And you can join the conversation. Find us on Twitter or Facebook, SparkCBC, or at our online home, cbc.ca/spark. I'll be there. Hope you will be too. I'm Nora Young. Until next time, remember, even though you can't read a CAPTCHA, you are not a bot. You're not a bot. You are not a bot. I am not a bot. I'm not. I'm not a bot.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.